Hey, Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Guys, we have someone who has tons of experience in different fields. So it will be the person to tell us more about the history, let's say, of how we got here and what we can learn from this whole B2B and B2B sales and marketing and startup history. Because truth be told, we are going through some uncertain times for all the B2B SaaS out there. And yes, in a show when we talk about RevOps, where we talk about efficiency and we talk about how to support our stakeholders in aligning all the teams, looking back in history, and it's incredibly important. So welcome, Thomas, today president at Amplitude, with a huge experience from different fields, living internationally, originally from Copenhagen. Then I see here that you lived in South Africa. You then moved to US working for Microsoft, then Dropbox. I mean, if I look at the LinkedIn, I let you guys look into it. But to kick it off, Thomas, Copenhagen, is this this neighborhood that we know in Copenhagen with the weed and all, is that still a thing, or how is the scene in Copenhagen regarding that?
Well, I gotta start by disclosing it's not a scene I'm very familiar with. I haven't lived in Copenhagen for just over 30 years, actually.
Oh, yeah,
31,
wow.
Year, 31 years. It's been a while. I was in Copenhagen, gosh, a month ago. I try to go once or twice a year, my family, my parents, my brother, aunt, uncle, et cetera, still living there. So I try to go and visit once or twice a year. What's that?
The happiest citizens in the world, based on many surveys, right?
It seems to be the case, right? it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So, how did it all start? This uncertainty in the market, Thomas. I would like to switch a little bit through current and past. You know, yeah. I'm a major in history and geopolitics, so I love to learn from the history. So I would like to understand, how do you see it, what's happening today in the market, and how we ended up here, and were we here before?
Well, you can learn a lot from history. I also love history. Look, life is amazing. You can learn so much from history, and certain things comes in cycles. So I saw the boom of the dot-com in the mid-late 90s and the bust in early 2000. Then you had the global financial crisis in 08, 09, 2010. And then here we are again. Now, it's very different this time around. I would say what we're experiencing this time around, this is just a little bit of a reset of multiples. Contraction of funding from PE and VCs, and a little bit back to normal, perhaps after 10 years and up and up and up. Then, of course, the very unfortunate, crazy pandemic time where you initially had a big down at the start of pandemic, and then a software market, B2B market, that just skyrocketed and then subsequently has reset itself. I think during the pandemic, there was an initial spike in business for a lot of companies out there. And it was somewhat artificial, and somewhat what we're going through right now is a little bit of a reset in terms of what do customers actually need out there? What's the business out there? And subsequently, you're seeing a normalization of multiples, specifically for private companies and for some categories out there. The larger caps, as you're probably fully aware of, have actually done a pretty amazing job in maintaining their valuations. But there's definitely a refocus back to basics. Back to basics, such boring things as preserve your cash. Be careful with your cash flow. Get to profitability. Don't invest crazy ahead of the curve at a blitz scaling, as you may be familiar with. Those days are gone. Now you've got to be a little bit more responsible in terms of how you deploy your cash and how you build business for longevity.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we hate to say this, like we as RevOps, ops guys, we hate to say the word or the sentence, I told you so, right? When we think of making more efficiency within our structure, right? Like the audience here or whoever is into RevOps, they are these operational freaks and these kind of geeks when it comes to processes and cleanness of data. And, you know, Amplitude, like you guys are giving a lot of insights on product analytics and you have really good data. So you know what I'm talking about. But why is it that, in your view, that only when it's crisis, right, there is more a need of such people, and why when it's everything going well, you know, we totally ignore it and we are not looking at this aspect of things?
Well, I don't think I'm the contrarian here. I think there's many business leaders out there like me that actually thinks a little bit differently about it. I actually, if anything, I could be accused, if anything, for having over-invested into what I would call revenue excellence and operations and all-up go-to-market strategy when times were good. I believe that is the time where you've got to go in and get clear on your strategy, get clear on your engines, what's your ICP, what's your go-to-market, and what's the right tech stack and processes and operations that support it. So, look, I don't actually think that it's the other way around. Now, what does happen when markets get tighter? Of course, what happens in a go-to-market revenue excellence and operation type function is that you do go in and you ask yourself even harder questions and more critical questions around where can you optimize the engines. Now, my argument would be that should be a 24/7. Whether times are good or bad, you should always be looking at that. Whether you're looking at productivity, ROI from how you deploy cash into demand gen, including ABM. So I don't think in my book it's something that is uniquely that you focus more on now that times are a little bit more challenging, or if you like, times are back to perhaps a little bit more normal times.
Yeah, so what would be great to pick your brain a bit, if we have you here, of a 101, you know, operational, or how you call it, go-to-market system that today could be relevant. Like, what are some bases that, as you said, even if things are good or bad, we need to have this well done? And then we can go into different other scenarios, see what we can develop.
Yeah, perhaps let's start by talking a little bit about the go-to-market tech stack. So what technologies do you use across sales, marketing, customer success, partners, professional services, and so forth? Look, Romeo, here's what I think has happened. I think a lot of companies out there went a little bit overboard in buying in go-to-market technologies, and ended up finding themselves with a broad array, a really large stack of go-to-market systems and tools. What happened in that process is I think it got out of hand. And I think that it got to a point where, not only from a go-to-market RevOps and operational perspective, is it challenging to manage all these systems and tools and get the maximum value out of it and make sure that data flows in the right way, and. But moreover, think about the customers. The customers as in your salespeople, your customer success managers, professional services, delivery folks, and so forth. Now they're sitting with 5, 10, 15 different tools, systems. It becomes overwhelming. Yeah. And at the end of the day, you get tools and data fatigue, and I don't think you get an optimal value out of it. So what I believe right now is there's never been a better time for consolidation. Consolidate your technology stack and make very wise choices. Gone are the days, I believe, where you can afford to have 20 point solutions, but rather as much as you can, go and consolidate. Consolidate on those vendors that have made smart investments into shifting from being a product play, a point solution play, into a platform, and leverage those fewer vendors better, get to economics of scale with those vendors, with those partners actually, and make it easier for your internal customers, whether it's in marketing or sales or customer success, to get their job done so they can focus more time with the customers, less on internal systems, tools, and processes. That to me is the shift. By the way, in my day job at Amplitude, that's exactly what we're doing for our customers' digital analytics and digital experience. We are the leading platform in our field. And we made the shift some time back from being a digital analytics product to being rather a platform around which we spin a number of other services and products that other vendors would be out there selling us one-off point solutions. We integrated into our platform, providing our customers with a better consolidated view. I look always to be eating my own dog food, or if you like, drinking your own champagne. So I'm doing that exact same myself internally in terms of the tech stack we're using across marketing and customer success and sales and partners and pro services and whatever other components that may sit in your go-to-market.
Yeah, I mean, I remember 2016 when I was working for conversion rate optimization SaaS tool, that Amplitude was one of the choices because of the what you offer in your, even in your free version, like having be able to doing user journeys, and I think it was up to 1 million events at one point. I don't know how much it was in 2016. There was this.
We've increased it ever since. If anything, we may be too generous in what we offer to to our customers that are on our starter version or free version. But we're huge believers in helping companies out there, whether they're SMBs, small companies, startups, get them started. Help them to better understand their customers and their journey so they can build better products for the customers and better monetize their customers.
I want to go back to this consolidate part because I was talking with these guys from there is a company called Insider. They are from Turkey, quite good in e-commerce.
Yeah.
And they were telling me also that like e-commerce nowadays is like really, really hard. Yeah. And they were saying exactly what you said, that they are trying to consolidate. So because things are more divided. So that means that all these smaller companies or these smaller SaaS businesses will disappear, or they will be bought by others, or what will happen? Because to be honest, why did we get here? I suppose that these smaller SaaS companies got a bunch of funding. They increased their sales force, and then when times were good, the SDRs went out there and they sold to everybody everything. You're like SaaS was selling to SaaS, right? Yep. And then you have a bunch of different teams, each one using different tools. The data there is a huge discrepancy. And whenever you put Salesforce or HubSpot in front of them, they say, oh, it's too expensive. Now, so the comparisons are also made wrong because they are not made as a full platform. They are just one single piece of the pie. So what you're saying, like, I'm just curious, like, what will happen then with these smaller or how can we adapt a more platform type of consolidated go to market while we are stuck with the smaller folks?
Look, I think the harsh reality in today's market is if you are a smaller B2B company and you haven't gotten to scale, you're still private, you got to look at your P&L. You got to look at cash on hand. You got to look at your burn rate, and you got to make some tough decisions. You got to make sure that you preserve cash so you can be in this game for the longer term. And that will require changes in a lot of startups out there, private startups specifically. It's not an environment where it's particularly easy, if at all possible, to raise funding right now. Specifically also, you know, if you have founders, CEOs sitting that have done huge raises back in 2021 with very large valuations and are not willing to take down rounds, it becomes a very challenging environment. So number one tip is you just got to take care of your cash. You got to preserve your cash. You got to take some tough decisions to make sure you can be in it for the long term. So that would be my first thing. Then the second thing is you got to go back to your roots and remember what you are. It's very, very few sales and marketing led B2B companies out there that have won, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, what tends to win and what should win, in my opinion, is the product, the best experience, the best platform. That should win. That's what the customers deserve out there. So if you are a smaller startup and we're looking to make some of the tougher choices, ironically, me being the go-to-market guy, I would say go and make some tougher reductions in go-to-market and support functions, but make sure you continue to invest into product and engineering so you can continue to innovate and make sure you bring the very best product and platform to market. The other thing I would say is in this world of consolidation, if you are in a category and you're just covering up a small piece of the pie with a point solution, you've got to ask yourself some tough questions around both the TAM and the SAM. So what is over time the available dollars or euros and what's the actual spend right now? And you'll probably find as a point solution that it is fairly immaterial, which begs the question, can you get to scale? So you have to make a pivot away from one product into finding a way of running a platform orientation. That is what the customers are looking for. They're looking for scale. They're looking for ROI, they're looking for simplification, and many are also looking to save money in this environment.
Got it. So we have this consolidation, but now I'm curious a bit about what go-to-market should you choose and how you do this choice, right? Because, I mean, I just want to go back to your experience. You started at Dell even before in 92 in a way sales, right? So you went through some experiences out there and you saw some different strategies for go to market, right?
Right.
So I'm just trying to get out this ultimate $1 billion question, right? Like I have this, I consolidated everything, things are working relatively okay, but where should I invest the money? Which GTM makes it? How should I choose it? What should I do? Right.
Right. And that is the billion-dollar question, right? Look, I think the answer is not that difficult. You gotta understand and look at your ICP, your ideal customer profile. So you gotta understand what's the use case you're solving for. And who is the persona or personas, if it's plural, that you are helping and selling into? By understanding that, you can then start to get a better gauge on how do they want to be engaged? How do they want to be sold to, if there is a sale at all? So you have a number of choices. What I believe in is if it's doable, do a multi-channel go-to-market. In other words, don't necessarily just rely on one way of interacting with customers, number one. Number two, as much as you can, automate. Now, the most obvious example to provide right now is talking about startups and SMBs. How do you want to serve them ideally? Well, if you can, leverage PLG, product-led growth, classic self-serve, find, try, buy. Run an engine that requires very few humans to run that go-to-market. And you will also probably find that the customers and the personas you're dealing with in that space, that's actually how they prefer to buy. So there's this notion of understand your ICP, understand the use case and the value you're delivering, understand the personas, and then engage with them in the way they want to be engaged with. Now, in what I do day to day at Amplitude, there's so many startups and SMBs and small teams and larger companies that want to work with Amplitude. And it tends to be the product persona, so chief product officer, VP product, but it could also be a marketeer, a growth marketeer. It could also be someone in RevOps. It could be someone in data or engineering. By and large, many of those folks, they're smart, they're in the community, they're well-informed, they spend time online and educate themselves. They actually don't want to be called by a salesperson. They want to, through word of mouth, figure out what is the best approach and then go and self-serve. So PLG, to me, is so critical in so many different components of B2B. Now, conversely, let's go to the other extreme, Romeo, where you're talking about a large potential customer, where you're talking about contract values that are $500,000 or $5 million. It is highly, highly unique to this day that those customers can be served in a transactional, machine-driven manner. There, you probably will find that you need more of the classic enterprise seller and customer success manager and solutions engineer engaged. However, there's been a very big change on two fronts. As I look at where we are today versus where we were 10, 15, 20 years ago, the big change is number one, the sellers, the SEs, the customer success managers, you got to understand your product. You really have to deeply understand the product and turn away from being a seller and rather being an ambassador of the customer, where you really help the customer get to value. So the days of the steak eating, golf playing seller, it's kind of gone. You gotta go up through the ranks and get to understand your category, your domain, the use cases, and be able to deliver value to the customers. So that to me is one big change in that enterprise sales field. And then the other obvious change is with the arrival of the incredible tech stacks we have available today and with the amount of data that's out there. And then of course, I have to say AI, right? So in that all that being available, sales now, go-to-market is both an art and a science. Yes, you still need to go and engage large customers, but you got to use clever tools, systems and tools and AI to better understand where's the prospect, where's the customer at, what is their propensity to buy, what does the current stack look like, and how can you best solve for that? So today, when you look at sellers, sales managers, sales leaders, and the supporting RevOps function, getting that intelligence in, leveraging all the available tools out there, that is now critical. You can't rely just on the seller going and performing magic. Those days are kind of gone.
Yeah, also in the book, Jolt Effect, there was a lot around the customer, especially for enterprise, that there is a lot of customer indecision, especially now with all these overwhelming tools. So you as a salesperson, you really need to adopt this more consulting and taking by the hand type of approach.
Yeah.
Because what sometimes we don't understand is that whoever is on enterprise side deciding on, let's say, a tech stack to go with, it's their job on the line at the end of the day. So it's obviously that there is a lot of uncertainty for them, or there is a lot of due diligence that needs to be made because, one, a lot of information, two, is the job on the line. So it's help them with that indecision.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people are asking, and me too, I'm just wondering, where is the line between, you know, the PLG and then adding that more human factor, right? Like, because you might have also this mid-market, right? Like, because we talked about the two extremes, but when do I know that I need to add that human interaction to the to that PLG? Or when do I know that I don't need such a senior sales guys that are selling for enterprises, but it's okay to have a mid-experienced type of competencies in the team, so I don't overpay them, going back to the P&L, right?
Look, the answer is it depends. It depends on the category you're in, your average, your ASP. It depends on the scale, the size you're at, and the health of your P&L, how you approach all of it. But what I will say is the line for when you deploy the classic enterprise sales engine has gone up significantly. And also the way to think about it has also changed. The simple way of thinking about where do you deploy an enterprise that used to be, you know, classic simple segmentation, pivoting around size of company measured by number of employees. Those days are gone. Rather, what you want to do now is you want to go and deploy data to really understand propensity to buy and also understand TPAR, total potential ARR from a set of prospects, and then zoom in and focus on it. So what I'm trying to say is, if you go and deploy a TPI analysis, total potential ARR, and overlay it with propensity analysis, and you decide that you want to go and say serve 1,000 customers across Europe or 5,000 prospects globally, that list will look radically different than if you just cut it by size of company. So applying that intelligence now into your segmentation that then governs how you deploy your resources where you use sellers, that's probably the way to go.
So how can you add this like analysis? Like what, like do you guys at Amplitude help with this or how? Because
I described here is not an area that Amplitude provides a service in. It was more around how we actually approach it ourselves or how we go to market. So we obviously have a pretty good understanding of our ideal customer profile. Mm-hmm. We understand the personas. So we have a pretty good understanding by verticals, what works well. We have also made some choices, which is, not all markets are born equal. You know, there's a golden rule of thumb, you know, the 80-20 rule, you know, 80% of your business comes from 20%. That also applies to countries. So initially when you are at a certain scale, you want to focus on key markets. So that's another pivot. Then of course you can go in and leverage a bunch of tools and data to understand where that list of prospects are in terms of the current tech stack. You can through public domain go and get some good learnings around that. You can then go and overlay it with some assumptions around, well, at a certain customer size in a certain vertical, based on our learnings from our current customer set, we can drive a hypothesis that customer XYZ, they probably have a total potential ARR over time, somewhere between A and B, in terms of millions of dollars or euros. And then overlay it with propensity analysis. So do you have some indicators leveraging, for example, Sixth Sense as a tool to understand where should you go and focus your seller's time? And where should you go and spend time and dollars through your ABM engine as well and demand gen overall? I mean, those are just some components that goes into it, but that's the short version of what I would say is the reality today.
And are you able, because, you know, if I'm doing, for example, my Six Sigma certificate now, because I really love the idea of bringing manufacturing type of processes into GTM, right? Like, and one of the things that I see a lot in Six Sigma is this benchmarking. And this is something I seem really missing in our space. Like we don't know how to bench. I mean, how will I benchmark the GTM metrics? Like what you just said now, is it even possible or how would you do it?
It's first of all, let me start by saying, Romeo, this one is not an easy one. And we all struggle We all struggle with it. And yeah. I can't tell you how often I've been sitting in executive meetings or board meetings and have had lively discussions around whether, you know, sales productivity should be X or Y or whatever the other measures may be. Now, there are actually some benchmarks you can get. Some are available through VC firms. So if you're sitting in a company and you have an investor from the VC community or from the PE community, you'll probably find that that's a good place to go and get some data and anonymized data. Mm-hmm. And then there are some companies. There are some very good research and consulting firms. For example, in the US, there's one called Alexander Group. They do an annual B2B SaaS, PaaS, IaaS set of benchmarks across a bunch of data that I think you would find interesting. It could range, for example, from seller productivity that will at least allow you to get some indication of, are you within a normal range or are there some real red flags that stand out from that?
And at which size does it make sense to even look at this? Because I suppose it's quite costly for a mid-market company. So I'm just trying to understand for our audience, when would it make sense for me to go to look into benchmarking?
Well, look, whether I'm a $17 million firm or a $300 million firm, I would look at benchmarks. But the benchmarks I would look at would be different. So if I'm a $17 million firm, some of the things I'll go and benchmark is, what's my mix between product and engineering headcount versus go-to-market headcount? And try to understand, am I in line with the market? I would even go and look at simple benchmarks such as number of people employed relative to my top line. I would, in this day and age, I would, if data is available, I would also go and look at other companies my size, stage, and understand where they are on their cash flow and profitability journey, just to understand, what can I learn from other markets? Am I ahead of my ski tips, or am I under investing and so forth? And then as you get larger, I think there's another set of benchmarks that become far more interesting as you drill into the detail. And that could be, for example, as I mentioned earlier on, one area could be something simple as seller productivity to go and look at. But of course, as you go and look at PLG, for example, it becomes a very different discussion. Then you go through the entire funnel and you look at conversion rate, looking at cost to serve, cost of acquisition, and there's so many wonderful measures you can go and benchmark on there. Churn becomes a big thing to go and benchmark on, and so it depends a little bit on your size, stage, how you go to market, on what you go and look at. Right? I've been very, very lucky in my career, including right now, that I'm involved in a number of companies, both at Amplitude as my full-time job, and then my evening weekend job is I advise a number of companies. I sit on a couple of boards. I've invested in some companies, and they are across all stages from seed to public and in between. And that's a really interesting experience. You know, one of the things you learn is this notion of, are you stage appropriate? Are you investing in the right way? Do you have the right people on board that can deliver today, but also a future proof for the next couple of years? Have you deployed the right tech stack and so forth? But the one universal thing I've learned across this Romeo, and it wasn't always so clear to me, is there's one critical hire that I will prioritize super, super high. And I may surprise many by saying, I'm not talking about the sales leader. What I'm actually talking about is what I would call the go-to-market strategy and operations leader, or the RevOps person, depending on the stage you're at. That person is critical for you setting up the business in the right way and understanding where you invest. And I think some companies, specifically in the earlier stages, overlook that function at their own demise. So my two cents of advice is, prioritize hiring for that person, for that person or for that team. And the earlier you do it, the better off you'll be.
And you said something that I'm curious about, GTM or RevOps, depending on which stage you are in.
Yeah.
Can you clarify that a bit? Like, what do you mean? Like, which stage? Like,
yeah. I mean, I think the smaller you are, you're probably a little bit more focused initially just on sales operations or sales excellence. I think typically as you get to a larger scale and a later stage as a company, you probably start to look more holistically across the entire go-to-market stack. But again, it depends. It depends which category you're in and how you serve your customers. I would argue, for example, if you are a company that is primarily scaling through PLG, you probably want to look at from day one across your entire go-to-market stack and understand how you're performing. So that becomes more of an integrated motion as opposed to just the RevOps motion, which would be more pertaining to earlier stage companies that are focused on serving their customers through enterprise.
Mm. I would like to switch a bit the topic and go back to history. I was thinking, okay, you have this experience in sales since the 90s. And today we are in this AI world. Just if you reflect back, what were some periods of your experience where you have like big changes in what was top of mind? And when were those, what was that thing that was always like top of mind in your career?
Well, I mean, I've seen some massive shifts. I will call out two massive shifts. Number one, I still remember the happy-go-lucky 90s, early, mid, late 90s, where it was an analog world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The internet was only ever so slowly starting to arrive in more commercial deployment, 96, 97, 98. As a matter of fact, one of my first manager roles was working for a well-known hardware manufacturer and helping them for the territory I was in at the time to get their online, their .com business up and running, including enabling them to transact. I mean, that was revolutionary at the time. Today, it seems bloody obvious, right? But at the time, really? Are we going to have a machine doing all the work that human beings are doing today? That was a big shift. And then, of course, came the next massive, massive shift in B2B. And that was the shift from selling licenses into subscriptions, into online, into SaaS. Mm. And, you know, some companies really struggle with that transition. And I've been part of driving, call it on-premise to SaaS, or on-premise to subscription to SaaS multiple times. One of the experiences I had was at Microsoft, which was an incredible experience, but also very challenging because you had this at that time, the unique challenge that you have an existing customer base. We've got to protect, in inverted commas, you've got to protect the revenue base, but at the same time, you know you need to make the shift to SaaS, subscription and SaaS.
Mm-hmm.
And right on. You got to get ahead of the curve, but it has some short-term implications for your P&L that at that time was very challenging to manage. And frankly, there were some amazing software companies in the early, mid-2000s, even in not so distant memory, that just didn't successfully manage to make that shift, and it cost them their lead position in that category, and they got taken over. One area that stands out to me as an example of that is, think about what happened to the likes of McAfee and Symantec, once incredible names in the world of security and AV, and they got taken out alive by incredible companies such as CrowdStrike that has done such a good job in building next generation AV. In the SaaS world.
Yeah, there's some. They were very good in antivirus, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So there's been some big shifts.
So that was top of mind. And now I suppose AI is top of mind. And how, or is there any other topic, and how you guys try to work with this whole change in technology?
Yeah, AI is of course top of mind for not only Amplitude, but also other companies where I work as an advisor and board member. AI can revolutionize, of course, how customers can leverage your technology in far more effective and efficient ways, but also just can help how you as a company are engaging with your prospects and customers. We, for example, we're going through a tech stack change at Amplitude right now, where we are moving from three or four different vendors in our tech stack into consolidating with one. And as part of this one vendor's stack, what they're offering up in the sales process is essentially an AI guide. An AI guide that will assist our SDRs and sellers on what to say next when they are on a Zoom call or on a phone call with a customer. So you literally have a gong-like assistant listening into the call and is real-time processing that and coming up with suggestions on what should you say next. So sounds very simple, but boy, oh boy, what a way to revolutionize how you train and enable your sellers and SDRs to do a better job. Crazy, right?
And I must ask then, maybe at one point, some of our jobs will be replaced for the better, right? But one thing that I get a lot in Europe, where I am based in, there are a lot of not only SaaS companies but software development companies, right? So the typical service or IT outsourcing type of companies, because in this region there are very good technical people, right? But now the question is, and the market is also got hit because of the tech layoffs and so on. So the question is, having GitHub Copilot and all other coding assistance type of tools, you know, do we need this technical knowledge, and how should we actually leverage AI so that we are not in the wave of next layoffs?
Right.
I know it's a hard question. It's just like something that is top of mind here.
Well, I mean, let's look at history as an example. Let's look at Denmark as a many, many years ago, essentially being an economy that was about fishing and farming.
You still have a lot of farming. It's one of the biggest.
But does it employ the majority of the Danish workforce? Not at all.
No.
The Danish workforce has forward integrated into be a full services economy for all intents and purposes. An IP economy is probably a better way of describing it. So to answer your question, history is full of examples again and again of how technology in so many different ways have enabled humankind to move on and to be able to up-level themselves and find even better, more effective ways to use their time and drive impact. So look, I don't mean to be no empathy and say I don't recognize that this is going to be challenging, the AI movement as one example, for a bunch of people with the skills they are today. But you got to look forward, and you got to ask yourself, where's the market going? How can you retrain yourself or further train yourself to continue to be able to add value? And as I said, that's the ongoing history. Look, change, you got to get comfortable with change. Change is here to stay. History is proof of that.
Before we end, I would love to know your recommendations for the young folks out there who are building their careers, you know, 20s, 30s, like myself, like, In these times of AI and in these times of very rapid changing, what would be your recommendation and advice so they go a little bit inspired forward in terms of where should they invest their time in?
Hey, I believe life shouldn't be linear. I believe life should be full of adventure and experiences. So I would recommend the listeners to optimize for getting experiences, getting diverse experiences. Train this one. Train your brain to be able to adapt to new challenges. And don't take the linear path and look for the career trajectory or necessarily look for the next job that gives you 20% more salary. Go and do something that is non-obvious. Make some career choices that gives you exposure to a different category, some different type of work, a different place in the world to work, so you get a different level of appreciation for diversity. By doing that, I think that over time, you optimize your life, your adventure, your experiences, but I actually also think you optimize your ability to take on even more later on in your career and ultimately probably to go further in your career than you otherwise would. So I'm a huge believer in diversity. Diversity in experiences, in adventure, in what you take on. And make sure you train this one, your brain, to be able to take on more later on. That would be my two cents on it.
Thanks a lot, Thomas. That was great. Thanks a lot for this nice thoughts and nice inspiration for us.
Yeah.
Where can people find you or learn more about you or see your talks or anything additional if they want to read or listen to more things about you?
I would encourage you to go and find me on LinkedIn. I'm there under my full name, Thomas Neergaard Hansen. And I do regular posts. I do regular videos. For example, I'm doing a 10-part series right now targeted at founders and CEOs and founding teams on how to think about go-to-market and how to scale it and what some of the traps are, what some of the myths are and the truths are. So that might be a fun one to go and follow.
Cool. Thanks a lot. Thank you guys for tuning in, listening from your car or from your comfort of your home. This was great, Thomas. Wish you a lot of great successes. And who knows, maybe we meet in Denmark or in Portugal or in Poland if you come over.
I'd love to. That'll be fun. Thank you for the invite. I've enjoyed this. This was fun.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You as well.